يا حيف، يا حيف يا حيف يا حيف يا حيف، اخ ويا حيف، زخ رصاص على الناس العزل يا حيف، واطفال بعمر الورد اعتقلن كيف، زخ رصاص.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bilal Saab, who is a visiting fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. Previously, he was a research analyst at the Brookings Institution and has conducted research on political and economic development in the Middle East at the Middle East Institute and on post-conflict reconstruction in Iraq at the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He has an article at CNN, Why Damascus Remains Eerily Calm. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bilal Saab.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you, Ian.
And it is obviously eerily calm in the center and in the capital of Damascus, although there was some substantial demonstrations on Friday in the outer suburbs, I believe, where the military opened fire. How close did they come to the center, those demonstrations?
Well, they got pretty close, but it's a little bit still away from central Damascus. It's interesting, as soon as I wrote the article, it was, I think it was only a day or so when I heard news of the increasing protests and the escalating violence in the suburbs. But keep in mind that last month, we did see some agitation and some demonstrations in several suburbs of Damascus. But yet again, it wasn't close enough to central Damascus.
But the point of your article at CNN, Why Damascus Remains Eerily Calm, is that there that unlike Libya, Tunisia, and Egypt, where the societies united against their oppressors and their dictators, Syrian society has yet to unite and is still divided. And it seems to be divided fairly exclusively along the Sunnis are the ones involved in the armed rebellion.
That's correct. You know, it's foolish to deny that there are obvious sectarian connotations to the Syrian uprising. Certainly that doesn't mean that the grievances of the Syrian people are not genuine and they are similar to ones felt by Egyptians, Tunisians, and other Arabs who have revolted against their national governments. But that sectarian dimension of the Syrian uprising is hard to miss. And for me, that tells me that it could be a big obstacle to why Syrian society has yet to fully unite, as well as the opposition, against their oppressors. It might be only a matter of time before they do that. I do realize that the Syrian opposition has moved forward in overcoming some of their divisions, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
So you mentioned in your article that the internationally recognized Syrian opposition figures such as Michel Kilo and Haytham Manna refused to join the Istanbul Syrian National Council, which is the umbrella body that is the political arm, if you will, and I guess the military arm is the Free Syrian Army. Explain to us who these people are and why they don't, if they're prominent opposition figures, why haven't they joined the movement?
Well, I mentioned the names of these two individuals simply because they have been leaders in their own right in their opposition against the Syrian regime. And they have really been recognized by not only Syrians, but also the international community. So those were really two important examples. Just for me to show the real divisions that are happening within the opposition itself. Michel Kilo is he has been portrayed as sort of the grandfather of the Syrian opposition, and he has been opposing the regime for a very long time. A quite prominent intellectual, very well known inside the country, very well respected. The reasons why, for example, he hasn't joined the Syrian National Council is because of some real disagreements on some of the issues that the Syrian National Council has taken, for example, external intervention. There's been some voices inside the Syrian National Council calling, perhaps in the beginning, for more forceful word international intervention against the regime, something that Michel Kilo has stood against. The role of the Arab League, perhaps having more faith in holding negotiations with the Syrian regime, something that the SNC has been adamantly against. The same goes for Haitham Manah, who's been a very prominent human rights lawyer, and who has been really at the forefront of the opposition against human rights violations by the regime. And just like Kilo, Haitham, not only is prominent on the street, but he has really led his own coordinating body. It's called the National Coordinating Body. And he's based inside the country. The problem with the SNC is that it's based outside the country. And those, and for that reason, it has lost some of its legitimacy, perhaps credibility, in the eyes of the Syrian people who are fighting on a daily basis on the ground. So the fact that these two people, in addition to a few others, but these are the two most prominent ones, that they haven't really embraced the SNC, tells me that there's still a lot of work to be done before a so-called opposition movement really speaks with one voice and brings its cause to the international community, and the international community will feel more confident actually to intervene and provide more effective assistance.
Again, I'm speaking with Bilal Saab, who's a visiting fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. He has an article at CNN, Why Damascus Remains Eerily Calm. But surely you could make the opposite argument, couldn't you, about opposition within Syria? If you're an opposition figure within Syria and you haven't been killed, doesn't that open you up to suspicion? Because that's how the Assads have operated over the decades. They either kill you or they co-opt you.
That's very true. You know, I've heard a lot of suspicions that, some of the opposition figures and bodies that have been operating on the ground have been nothing more than mouthpieces for the Syrian regime. And that's very true. But to call Haitham Manah and Michel Kilo as mouthpieces for the Syrian regime is not only wrong, but it's completely unfair. These are really genuine opposition figures that even the SNC itself would consider as nothing less than really leading the forefront of the being at the forefront, basically, of the struggle for freedom and against tyranny. But you're absolutely right. There are a lot of bodies on the ground that the regime sponsors, that the regime supports, and has them there simply doing their own bidding. That's absolutely correct.
So what's going on with Michel Kilo and Haitham Manah in terms of their relationship to the Syrian government? Why are they allowed to operate if they're credible voices for the opposition?
I think Haitham Manah and Michel Kilo are red line for the regime, simply because they have gained international recognition, international legitimacy in the eyes of all those who basically long for democracy in Syria. So for them to lock them in or perhaps, arrest them, assault them, would really bring significant cost to the Syrian regime. You might ask me at this point, what would they really lose? At the end of the day, they are, fighting an existential war against their opponents. Perhaps that might change. They might lock them soon. But In a very bizarre way, they see these two individuals as representing less of a threat to them because these two individuals have not completely given up hope on finding some sort of a political solution to the crisis, i.e. maintaining some sort of a dialogue and negotiations for leading a transition to a new future, basically. The Syrian regime does not really see them as a major threat. It actually sees the rebels as a threat, and perhaps also the SNC as a much bigger threat.
So there have never been any serious efforts on the part of the regime. They've rhetorically talked about reform for forever, never enacted it. And when the first rebellion took place, which was a mild, non-violent protest, they cracked down brutally. At this point, they're still talking about a referendum that nobody in the opposition takes seriously. I don't know about the two figures that we've been talking about. Now they've, you know, obviously they're getting support from Russia and China. In fact, the Chinese People's Daily has a front page editorial today castigating the West for stoking a civil war, and the International Red Cross or the Red Crescent trying to get into Syria to create a humanitarian corridor as the city of Homs is besieged, and there's a humanitarian catastrophe taking place there. So it's difficult not to imagine how this thing is not already a civil war. What's your reading on it, Bilal?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I have been saying for the past few months even that we are already in a state of civil war. You might not see the same events that we saw in 1975, 1990, Lebanon civil war, but the country is clearly divided along sectarian lines. The death toll is rising. The sectarian assassinations are evident, and the escalation on the ground is also obvious. It is perhaps not a full-blown civil war, but it's a sort of a gradually escalating civil war that that is as scary and as violent as a civil war that basically we saw in other countries in the Middle East. The reforms that you mentioned about, or the efforts to implement reforms by the Syrian regime, are merely symbolic. I mean, Assad at the end of the day needs to show his allies, primarily the Chinese and the Russians, and he needs to show them that he's a little bit serious about reform. He needs to provide them with diplomatic ammunition that the Russians and the Chinese can use at the Security Council to tell the United States and the others that, look, our friend and Bashar al-Assad is actually trying to implement reform, but he's unable to given the escalating violence on the ground. This is absolutely ridiculous. The regime is, for all sorts of reasons, structurally speaking, the very structure of the regime, is incapable of implementing general reforms, because if they do, they're out of power. So that is the paradox that you see in the behavior of the Syrian regime. It needs to show the world, and especially its allies, that it is trying to implement reform. But those reforms are really bogus. They're not real. They're symbolic. And they're used as propaganda to send a message to the world that Bashar al-Assad is trying, but he's simply incapable. He has to crack down on these so-called terrorists and armed gangs first.
So in your article, Bilal Saab, at CNN, Why Damascus Remains Eerily Calm, you point out the paradox that all these other revolutions that have taken place in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya, you point out that these are the major capitals, that's, you know, the revolution always starts with the sort of educated elite in these capitals and spreads out to the provinces. Now you have the reverse in Syria, where the uprising started on the border with Lebanon in the little poor town Deraa, I believe,
and then it
stayed in these other cities around the country. But so far, in Damascus and Aleppo, which is an Alawite city, have largely been untouched. Explain that paradox, if you will.
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to start in the capital, but if you look at the history of, the recent history of these three cases that you mentioned, whether it's Egypt, Libya, or Tunisia, and modern history of Europe, there's a specific point in those social revolutions when they hit the capital. And this is where things get really serious and the departure of the national government is imminent. Why we haven't seen that in Damascus yet, it's a little bit unclear. I mean, the Syrian people haven't been able to reach that critical mass that everybody talks about. We have discussed, you and I, the divisions within Syrian society. But central Damascus has been, like I say in the article, eerily calm. It's disappointing, obviously. But I talked to a lot of Syrians who pretty much share the same feelings and the thoughts that I wrote in the article. And they tell me it's a matter of time, but it might take longer than we all think. There's some homework, like I mentioned, that needs to be done first in terms of rallying the troops, unifying the opposition, some sort of coordination that needs to take place between the rebels who are actually fighting on the ground and those who speak political and who are based in Istanbul. There needs to be some sort of better coordination between the two. Absent all these, I call them social processes, social mobilization processes, Damascus is destined to remain calm. And it's quite unfortunate because it has to, if it doesn't have to start in Damascus, it has to end in Damascus. Because this is when we all figure out and realize that the days of Bashar al-Assad are numbered. At this point, it is really calm, and a large segment of Syrian society that includes the merchant class, those who have wealth, and those who do business with the regime, they're still siding with the regime. And a lot of ethnic minorities who are very much concerned about the future of Syria, should it be ruled by Islamists, and I'm talking about the Christians mainly, that ethnic communal group is very much on the fence. Not necessarily siding with the regime, but it's very much concerned about what would happen next. So it is staying home, not really joining the protest movement. And that all is just bad news for that critical mass that I just mentioned. They cannot really reach Damascus in large numbers, if at all, if they don't have that critical mass that everybody's waiting for. The images of Tahrir Square that we saw in Cairo have yet to be replicated in Damascus.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Bilal Saab.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Bilal Saab, who is a visiting fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. Previously, he was a research analyst at the Brookings Institution and has conducted research on political and economic development in the Middle East at the Middle East Institute and on post-conflict reconstruction in Iraq at the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He has an article at CNN, Why Damascus Remains Eerily Calm. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the prison breakout in Mexico.
من وين جيت من وين نبات